rank of charlatan as their leader, and he spent 4 years systematically dismantling any shred of credibility and decency in their political system. The screaming thugs climbing the steps of Capitol Hill looked, felt, and remained quiet, ominous. Americans, both liberal and conservative, have historically attributed such sins to what they contemptuously dismissed as banana republics. And yet, their own beloved country was suddenly exposed to be very similar, if not worse. But Americans must take a few steps back from the shock of January 6th and ask themselves, is this really the first and only time their democratic institutions have been under attack, compromised, or discredited? In fact, democratic institutions in the U.S. were under attack long before January 6th, and they will continue to be long after that traumatic day. But these assailants don't come looking like shamans or barbarians. They come clean, showered, and shaved, properly attired in business suits, perhaps looking gaudy, but perfectly respectable. Their clean shirts are ironed and button-downed, with matching ties, crisp pants, and jackets. They speak softly, produce their business cards, and offer other credentials. They greet security officers, exchange pleasantries, know their ways to the office of U.S. lawmakers, arrive on time, do their rounds, leave on time, and move on to the next luncheon appointment. They are lobbyists. They work for a living. Unlike the racist thugs who stormed the Capitol, lobbyists wield infinitely more power to corrupt the way a democracy works. Indeed, American democracy is compromised on an ongoing basis by interest groups, Wall Street executives, the gun lobby, the fossil fuel industry, and the Israeli lobby. This was the reality long before a gang of buffoons invaded Capitol Hill. The invasion of U.S. Capitol by lobbyists has had global consequences. In a major study titled Wall Street, Capitol Hill, and K Street, Political Influence and Financial Regulation, 2014, two International Monetary Fund officials, Dennis Eigen and Prachi Mishra, detailed the link between the political influence of the financial industry and financial regulation in the run-up to the global financial crisis, citing a connection between lobbying activities and the type of predatory deregulation that wreaked havoc on global economy. To be sure, the lobbying activities of pro-Israel groups, the fossil fuel industry, gun advocates, or Wall Street executives are perfectly legal. It is business as usual in the world of U.S. politics. The formation of voluntary associations is protected by the U.S. Constitution. But who actually gets to lobby? And for what nefarious purposes, from land theft to destroying the environment? It is here that the power of money and privilege come into play. These lobbies can be confronted through the power of mobilization, as we have seen through the Black Lives Matter movement or the Women's March. Such organizations can try to compensate for the power and resources they lack through their impressive numbers along with their presence in the streets, but in the current context, the game is rigged against them. Unfortunately, American people have reached the point where corporate lobbyists have overtaken their country's major democratic institutions. Pharmaceutical companies literally control matters of life and death. securing massive profits for themselves while ensuring a miserable subsistence for vulnerable communities. In 2015, The Atlantic reported that corporations spend more on lobbying, about $2.6 billion annually, than the total cost of funding the House and Senate combined. That is the real storming of the Capitol. But there is no ongoing investigation into the lobbyist invasion and occupation of the citadel of American democracy, not just on January 6, 2021, but 365 days a year.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our show aims to address the most important issues in the subcontinent, which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will see how social media giants are censoring human rights abuses in Kashmir. And we will also take a look at how the year-long farmer protest in India has finally paid off.
As the Kashmiris live under a brutal occupation, recurring communications blockade and prolonged aura of fear embroiled by torture, extrajudicial killings and kidnappings, social media giants are turning a blind eye to the human rights abuses faced by the people of the Indian-controlled Kashmir, even now when tensions are high in Kashmir because of the authorities are using innocent civilians as human shields. A report by the Kashmiri human rights organization Stand With Kashmir claims that since 2017, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other social media platforms have continually silenced Kashmir-related content. What's going on, and why is this happening? Take a look.
In August 2019, India's right-wing BJP government scrapped the autonomous status of Kashmir by revoking Articles 370 and 35A of the Indian Constitution as a part of Modi's campaign to take over the disputed territory. Internet was shut down, curfew was imposed, thousands of Indian troops were sent into the territory, and all opposing voices, including three former chief ministers of the state, were arrested. Even though curfews and internet blackouts were momentarily lifted, they have been regularly reinforced time and again. Up until today, there have been more than 300 instances of internet shutdowns in the disputed territory. But what's interesting is that even when the internet is available, social media conglomerates censor the voices of Kashmir which call for help. According to a 30-page report by Stand With Kashmir titled How Social Media Corporations Enable Silence on Kashmir, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other social media platforms have been silencing Kashmir-related content since 2017. According to human rights groups, the human rights abuses in Indian-controlled Kashmir now range from mass killings, enforced disappearances, torture, rape, and sexual abuse to political repression and suppression of freedom of speech, but Kashmiris have no way to tell the world about the atrocities themselves.
It's funny how social media giants like Facebook are on one hand criticized for being too soft on hate speech content, while on the other, they are readily censoring voices which are merely found offensive by the US government. After the US martyred Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in cold blood Facebook and Instagram accounts of all the uncountable number of journalists, activists, and common people who were posting in support of the slain general was shut down, and Facebook accepted that they had to comply with the requests of the US. Facebook did not even shy away from closing down the official account of Press TV, which is followed by 4 million people, simply because the US administration does not agree with it. Where's the freedom of speech, and is that all to do with the double standard policy of this monopoly?
A former Facebook product manager raised the alarm over the not-so-free and safe Facebook, leaking a trove of internal company documents to the Wall Street Journal. Francis Haugen uncovered the real face of Facebook to the world, and the company tried to hide away from the controversy by hurriedly changing the name of its parent organization from Facebook to Meta. According to the leaked internal company documents, which are also referred to as the Facebook files, Facebook has been aware of hate speech and calls for violence against groups like Muslims and Kashmiris, including posts of photos of piles of dead Kashmiri bodies with glorifying captions on its platform in India, but still, none of their publishers were blocked. The leaks also reveal that for the past 3 years, Facebook has also been conducting internal research of how Instagram affects young users, and Facebook's own findings were that Instagram is harmful to a large portion of young users, where teenage girls were among the most harmed. Researchers within the company reported that we make body issues worse for 1 in 3 teenage girls. Shockingly, this is just the tip of the iceberg. The papers provide revelations regarding topics ranging from toxic Facebook algorithms and dangerous artificial intelligence software to meddling in internal politics of countries and spreading false information.
Now, to have more insights, we are joined by Mrs. Naime Mahjoor, a columnist at Independent Urdu. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Mahjoor. Now, a 30-page report by Stand With Kashmir claims that since 2017, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other social media platforms have continuously silenced Kashmir-related content. Now, do you think this is true?
I think it is, because it has also been confirmed by many international organizations, human rights organizations, as well as the journalist organizations, including Access Now and CPJ, and others as well. Human rights organizations has also given report about this. Even in many judicial cases in India, the courts have also admitted it. There are also colleagues of mine in journalist fraternity and other social rights organizations whose social media accounts still remain closed until today, whether it is Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And you might have also seen that more than 1 million tweets of the account holders were held since 2019. Which had a mere, mention of Kashmir. This has also come in the public domain now. Since 5th of August 2019, when Jammu Kashmir was stripped of its semi-autonomous status, the region had no internet for the last 700 days. And even during the earliest period of COVID pandemic, when the internet was the lifeline of every single person to get information on how to deal with this pandemic, and in Kashmir, and it was total communication blockade. And then the majority of the population in Kashmir and Jammu and Kashmir, the whole region, considers these social media platforms, whether it is Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, they are certainly, complicit with the government in Delhi in disabling the thousands of accounts or restricting the content if there is any mention of Kashmir. There was a recent survey by some social activists in Kashmir. They give number of 600 account holders who are prominent journalists, social activists, human rights activists, and they don't have these accounts working now. because they are totally closed. And there are artists, even artists, actors, academicians, who are raising voice. Across the globe, they are mostly the Kashmiri diaspora. They were raising voice on the appalling situations of human rights in Jammu and Kashmir. Their outreach capacity has been curtailed by these social media platforms. So because of these strict restrictions on local media, and then there's only one narrative of Kashmir's story by Indian mainstream media, it was only the social media which common people have access to or can share their apathy. When you also deprive them of this digital right that's given to 8 billion population of the world, and you can realize the sense of helplessness, hopelessness Kashmiris are going through at this time.
Now, dozens of people from the Sikh community also protested at the Facebook headquarters in California. They also claimed that Facebook and Instagram have been censoring content posted in support of the Indian farmers and about the Sikh community. Now, do you think there's a pattern to this?
You can find this pattern in every part of India now. I mean, where minorities are facing intimidation and harassment every day. There are many reports that accounts and the content got disabled throughout the Paha farmers' agitation in the country, which is now running for the last 1 year. Recently, you might have seen the news, those viral videos also of Tripura, which is in northeast of India. And two social media handlers, including journalists, were slapped with the FIRs for tweeting ground reports on attacks on minorities and their religious places in Tripura. Some were arrested also, and there are many journalists which are still behind bars in Tripura. They haven't got even bail yet. Internet access was shut down there in Assam and Tripura, and still many are denied access to social media platforms. And then you might have also gone the story about this Amravati in Maharashtra, where Mumbai is the commercial capital of India, and there internet was shut down, social media was totally, shut down. There were restrictions all over media, and it's hard to get another shade of the story when you have got only one side of story from the mainstream media, which they get from the government itself.
Mrs. Mahju, I forgot to ask, why is Facebook censoring content in Kashmir in the first place?
I don't have any answer for that, to be honest with you. I think this question needs to be asked to these social media platforms, because why are they taking sides of the government? I mean, maybe it is because of their own commercial interests, or there is a lot of bonhomie, or the influence of the friendly relations of these rulers. But this also negates the claim of the democracies that every citizen has a right to speak or write. This pick and choose policy of the governments as well as of these social media platforms. I mean, you are allowing some people to speak and you are depriving other people not to speak. That puts a huge question mark on the credibility and impartiality of these social media platforms, because they themselves claim that they are the champions of free speech. So social media giants have become, I think, most doubtful in the eyes of the public now. So they need to restore this confidence among the people that they are not taking sides with the governments, which people the general impression is that.
Thank you for your precious time and knowledge, Mrs. Mahju. Now, let's see how people reacted on social media on the human rights abuses in Kashmir.
Khalid Baydun wrote, Instagram blocked his story when he tried to talk about crisis in Kashmir. Samir Yasir mentioned that the brutal killing of Shamima was underplayed by newspapers. Zabe tweeted no internet and communication facilities to be allowed in Kashmir which is total breach with international law and ethics, and still the whole world is silent. What Tyler tweeted, Modi pays a lot and tried to silence the media regarding the crisis in Kashmir.
In 2020, the BJP government led by Prime Minister Narendra Modi passed three controversial farm laws which sparked massive protests in the country. These laws essentially loosened rules that have protected India's farmers from the free market capitalists for decades. After a year of non-stop protests, the hard struggle of farmers has finally paid off. Modi has announced that the laws will be repealed. But what is it that led people to get angry with the laws in the first place?
The three laws being talked about are the Farmers Produce Trade and Commerce Promotion and Facilitation Act, the Farmers Empowerment and Protection Agreement of Price Assurance and Farm Services Act, and the Essential Commodities Amendment Act. These laws, which were introduced in September 2020, were met with widespread angst and widespread disapproval from farmers, who took to the streets to launch a robust protest. The laws were basically meant to deregulate the sector, allowing farmers to sell produce to buyers beyond government-regulated wholesale markets, where growers are assured of a minimum price MSP. This would mean that small farmers would be put up against big businesses, who would then ultimately negotiate prices according to their own holding power. And free market prices would mean that farmers would also lose out on price support for staples such as wheat and rice. The protests, which started off in Punjab, ultimately spread like wildfire. Protesters joined forces together on the streets in a year-long rift with the government, something which is being called the longest agrarian movement in independent India. The protesters were prepared for the long haul right from day one. They set up camp, had trucks full of food and water, and a zealous spirit which kept them united. It is said that after 1 year and more than 700 lives lost during the protests, the protesters have finally won. However, laws are yet to be repealed in the parliament, and let's not decide everything at the drop of a hat.
The farmers from Punjab, who predominantly belong to the Sikh religious minority of India, were the first to grasp the danger when Parliament passed the three controversial bills in a great hurry without a discussion or taking farmers' unions into confidence. The Sikhs since led the farmers' protests in India. Interestingly, Modi made the announcement of backing down from his decision on the occasion of birth anniversary of Sikhism's founder Guru Nanak, whom the Sikhs all around the world follow religiously even after his death.
The Sikh population consists of almost 30 million people around the world, and between 22 million to 28 million live in India. Of those who live in India, around 80% reside in North Indian state of Punjab, which borders with Pakistan. The announcement comes few months before key elections in five provinces of India, one of which is Punjab, where majority of the population are Sikhs. The government BJP party is performing poorly in Punjab, and where earlier farmers had made it almost impossible for BJP leaders to campaign or even hold meetings with their workers in the state. The party is now expected to take credit for undoing a mistake and deciding to bow down before the farmers as it aims to woo the Sikhs, who form the majority vote bank in Punjab. That's not it, however. The Sikh community have had their own differences with the Indian establishment and right-wing organizations in India. From the Golden Temple massacre in 1984 to the present situation of minority rights, the memory of Sikhs in India is etched with a series of tragedies. before independence, Sikhs had an empire of their own, and after independence, due to the ill treatment faced by their community, the Sikhs started demanding for a separate homeland of their own, what was called Khalistan Movement. Commentators claim that Modi is afraid that these protests could spark separatist sentiments in Sikhs. Modi's announcement comes right after Sikh community held a referendum in London on the question of whether Indian-governed Punjab should be an independent country. Thousands of people participated, and more referendums are to be held in Canada, EU, and other cities of the UK.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Anwar Rizvi, a South Asia analyst. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Rizvi. Now, could you please tell us why the farmers were unhappy with the farm laws in the first place?
Okay, I'm not going to go too much into the nitty-gritty of the law itself. I'm just going to give you a general overview of why the Indian government thought that the laws were necessary and why the farmers then rose up against the laws. So basically, India, despite all the technological advances and all the industrial advances that it has made in recent years, it is still a largely agrarian economy. Large parts of the Indian population still rely on agriculture as their main source of income. And particularly in the province of Punjab, which is almost entirely an agricultural state, agriculture in Punjab is not just an occupation, it's actually a way of life, it's part of the culture. And there have been practices that have been in place for decades, for centuries, and they work quite well for the farmers. Most of these farmers are not big farmers. They have small holdings, very small farms which they farm on. A lot of these farmers are not particularly literate. They don't totally fully understand the markets. They don't fully understand the supply and demand economics. So they rely on the middlemen, who are also, by and large, they're part of the community. Some of them could be village chiefs or other kind of community elders who act as the middlemen between these small farmers, who are the majority of the farming community in the Punjab and also as well as the rest of India. And these middlemen then help the farmers get their produce to the local markets, which are called the mandis, where they're then sold to the wholesalers. And also these middlemen will take care of the farmers by providing them loans when the crops have not been too great and the farmers are in need. And so therefore, these middlemen don't just help these farmers get their produce to the market, they also help them in many other ways. And because they are part of that very community where the farmers themselves come from, therefore, these middlemen are actually a lifeline for these farmers. Now, what the Indian government with this Farming Act wanted to do was to completely replace a tried and tested system, which had been in place for many centuries now, with a more corporate system. So they wanted to bring in big agro-industrial complexes where they would buy directly from the farmers, so buy the produce from the farmers, and then distribute that those products across India and obviously to other parts of the world. The farmers were not happy with that because quite simply they thought that something which they have tried and trusted for so long, for generations, is suddenly being replaced overnight with a more corporate system. A lot of these farmers do not understand how the corporate world works. They won't know who to deal with. They won't know the people who are running these big agro-industrial complexes. It would be a totally alien concept for them. And perhaps some reform was necessary, but such a drastic reform in such a short period of time was not something the farmers were willing to accept. Hence, they rose up in protest.
Last but not least, Mr. Rizvi, farm laws are being overturned now. Why couldn't the people pressurize the government in overturning the CAA?
That is a really, really good question, because the CAA, unfortunately, does not impact the overwhelming majority of the Indian population, the Indian citizens. It impacts people who have come from other countries into India. And the law itself is very discriminatory, because it blatantly excludes Muslims from applying, Muslims who've come in from other neighboring countries into India as refugees or asylum seekers or as workers, and it excludes them from applying for Indian citizenship on the basis they are Muslims.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Rizvi. So glad to have you on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media on farmer protests in India.
Claudia Webb, MP, a Member of Parliament for Leicester East, has appreciated Indian farmers and believes their protest is an example to the world how injustice must be defeated. Spiritually Speaking believes there are many lessons to take away from the Indian farmers' protest for organizing, for justice, and for individual happiness. Zara Sultana, MP, wrote a tweet about Indian farmers and mentioned that the will and determination of Indian farmers forced Modi to repeal his anti-farmer laws.
And that was our episode about censorship in Kashmir and farmer laws in India. We hope you enjoyed the episode. We will meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. Asked on Friday, 17th of December, whether he took personal responsibility for the disastrous North Shropshire by-election result, Prime Minister Boris Johnson suggested the problem was that everyone else was talking about the wrong issues. My job as Prime Minister is to get the focus onto the things that matter for all of us, he said. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Heather Stewart and Aubrey Allegretti. The piece is titled, He's in Real Trouble Now. Tory MPs are viewing Boris Johnson as the problem. Stay with us for more. Asked on Friday, 17th of December, whether he took personal responsibility for the disastrous North Shropshire by-election result, Prime Minister Boris Johnson suggested the problem was that everyone else was talking about the wrong issues. My job as Prime Minister is to get the focus onto the things that matter for all of us, he said. Yet after weeks of self-inflicted crises and the drip-drip of stories about lockdown-busting parties at the heart of Downing Street, many of his MPs believe that it is Boris Johnson himself who is the real problem, and some are warning he is now on borrowed time. Johnson faces an intensely challenging period. The Omicron wave is breaking over Britain, but his MPs are in open revolt against COVID restrictions. And the economic backdrop is deteriorating just as taxes are about to rise. And Simon Case's inquiry into the rule-breaking parties is yet to report. As one frontbencher put it, we're starting to enter a perfect storm. As the storm clouds gather, Conservative MPs are united in believing that if the government is to regain the public's trust, Boris Johnson will have to change his approach significantly, but divided about whether he is capable of doing so. He has to take some drastic action. He needs to show tangible action to show he gets it, said one frontbencher. By-elections, where opposition parties can pour resources into a single seat, are representative of what might happen at a general election. Liberal Democrat leader Ed Davey visited North Shropshire 5 times, for example. But scores of anxious Tory MPs will nonetheless have been scrutinising the result and wondering what their own fate might be if the voters continue to feel they want to give the Tories a kicking, as the party chair Oliver Dowden put it. Much smaller swing against the Tories than the extraordinary 34% seen on Thursday would put scores of Conservative seats into the Liberal Democrats' sights. A 20% swing would wipe out Michael Gove in Surrey Heath, Dominic Raab in Esher and Walton, and Steve Bryan in Winchester, for example, among many others. Boris Johnson has few genuine friends in the parliamentary Conservative Party, and his popularity with colleagues was always contingent on his campaigning prowess. Yet one fear his MPs now have is that the very qualities that once made Johnson a winner with the public, his roughishness and devil-may-care approach to politics and life in general, are precisely those that have become electorally toxic. Paula Surridge, an elections expert at the University of Bristol, says, "My instinct is that he's in real trouble now, because I think what you're getting is a blend of the grief and anger and emotion of the last 18 months attaching itself to these endless stories of parties and rule-breaking. And I think that's going to be a really dangerous combination and really difficult for both Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party more generally to shake off." These issues attach themselves to people when they feed into the perceptions people already have of them. I think this does not feed into that perception, both of what Boris Johnson's like, but also the one rule for them, another rule for us, not looking out for the little guy perception of the Conservative Party. You're back to the nasty party. With opinion polls now consistently giving Labour a modest lead, one veteran Conservative said MPs with small majorities were likely to panic. "A lot of my colleagues are driven by fear, and they'll get angry if they see their future being put at risk," they said, adding that recent events had taken the Teflon off Boris. The North Shropshire result, a Liberal Democrat win in a Leave seat, also raised questions about whether Brexit was starting to lose its hold over the electorate. That could be bad news for Boris Johnson, who was able to unite voters in disparate seats in 2019 by promising to get Brexit done. If Brexit is starting to become a less crucial determinant of voting behaviour, he will need to find another potent argument to hold his electoral coalition together. And many MPs are not convinced levelling up is it. Johnson's colleagues are now calling for a reset, including an overhaul of the Prime Minister's Downing Street operation and a new chief whip, after a series of poorly handled recent votes, including this week's humiliating rebellion on COVID restrictions. Others would like to see heavyweights such as Jeremy Hunt, Greg Clark and Leon Fox brought back into the cabinet. But senior MPs are also sceptical about how much Johnson is likely to be able to sharpen up his act. It's not about Downing Street, it's him, one minister said. We have the problems we have because either he's caused them or his whole approach means other people do things they really shouldn't. So it will be down to what he chooses to do. If they come to believe that Boris Johnson is no longer an electoral win, they could decide to trigger a vote of no confidence, which, if Johnson lost, would mark the end of his premiership. It takes 54 Conservative MPs to kick off such a vote, but a much larger 181 to win it. Sir Graham Brady, the inscrutable chair of the Backbench 1922 committee, never reveals how many letters of no confidence he has received until the threshold is reached. Few backbenchers believe many more than a dozen, perhaps 20, are likely to have accumulated so far. But with each crisis, particularly when self-inflicted, like the Peterson fiasco, more are likely to drop into Brady's inbox. The veteran backbencher Sir Roger Gale spoke for many colleagues on Friday morning when he said, "Nobody wants a leadership challenge in the middle of the pandemic, but one more strike and he's out."
Depression is a mood disorder that causes a persistent feeling of sadness and loss of interest. It affects how you feel, think, and behave, and can lead to a variety of emotional and physical problems. Patients may have trouble doing normal day-to-day activities and could sometimes even feel as if life isn't worth living. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this one is Aperture. Depression may require long-term treatment with a host of pills, antidepressants, anxiolytics, neuroleptics, and tranquilizers, but sometimes the cure could be much worse than the ailment. Thousands of documented cases prove that the prescription of such drugs have led to suicide, acts of violence, and even murder. This week's documentary, Death by Prescription, reveals the shocking truth about psychotropic drugs and a healthcare system that perhaps undermines the potential dangers of such medication.
Mark was 48 years old when he committed suicide in October 2013. He was suffering from recurring back pain and had had an operation, but the cure was worse than the ailment. It hit him hard, and he was prescribed antidepressants. Mark was the father of two children and had never had suicidal thoughts before, but in less than a week, the medication sent him into madness. His sister Florence has still not recovered from it. Is an antidepressant responsible for the death of Florence's brother? These heartbreaking events are echoed in thousands of documented cases across the world. Psychotropic drugs are under the spotlight. Antidepressants, anxiolytics, neuroleptics, sleeping pills, and tranquilizers are supposed to stitch together the fragilities of the soul. They save many lives. But can they also lead to suicide or even murder? What are these psychotropic medications that are sometimes held responsible for acts of violence? First off are antidepressants, the grandfather of the new wave being Prozac. This antidepressant is supposed to act upon depressive states, deep sadness, psychic fatigue, and anxiety. It should give a mood boost in order to bring the patient back to a stable condition. In France, it's taken by at least 6 million people. Next, we have the benzodiazepines. with the most widespread examples being anxiolytic drugs such as Valium or Xanax, but also a high number of sleeping pills. They treat states of anxiety, panic attacks, and insomnia. Unlike antidepressants, they bring the mood down to calm the anxiety. It's a bestseller in France. 11.5 million people take it each year, more than one in four adults. Finally, there are various tranquilizers and powerful neuroleptics, which influence the nerves. Nobody disagrees with how useful these medications are, as they act upon serotonin, a neurotransmitter that regulates the mood. But depending on individuals, they can short-circuit the brain, which can be dangerous and even fatal. In France, Professor Evan is one of the only doctors to sound the alarm. He has compiled or translated a handful of reports and studies that warn against psychotropic drugs. At what moment do these medications become dangerous? For benzodiazepines, whose effects are immediate, it's during the first days of the treatment, especially when coming off the medication. For a large number of people, anxiolytics or sleeping pills can be more addictive than heroin, which is why the treatment shouldn't last longer than a few weeks. As for antidepressants, which don't take effect until 2 or 3 weeks of use, murder or suicide can occur during the first few days of treatment, whenever the dosage is increased or when the medications are stopped. When this happens, a devastating rebound effect can occur that places some patients in a state that they feel compelled to continue. Before taking his life, Florence's brother was right at the beginning of his treatment. In his letter, he speaks of having acid in his body. Are prescriptions given too readily in France? To allow us to find out, we went to 6 randomly chosen medical clinics equipped with a hidden camera. 95% of psychotropic medication is supplied by general practitioners. Our scenario will be simple, going through a rough patch due to losing a job. 5 minutes and 32 seconds was all it took to get a prescription of anxiolytics during the first consultation. The second doctor hands over a prescription of antidepressants, which he confirms have virtually no side effects whatsoever. The third is not strictly in favor of psychotropic medication, but strangely, he still supplies Seroplex, an antidepressant. Only the fourth finds it too early to give a psychotropic medication in such a case. Antihistamines are also used to treat allergies, but they can facilitate sleep. The fifth proposes an anxiolytic. She suggests a half tablet, then a whole, then two, then up to four a day. The prescription lasts 3 months, whereas the recommended limit is 8 weeks due to the extremely addictive effects of Xanax. If that isn't enough, she suggests adding an antidepressant. But the record was beaten by the last doctor, who proposed both an anxiolytic and an antidepressant in only 2 minutes. Everybody's happy, except when psychotropic medication drives somebody mad. Here's a brilliant young girl, Aurélie. 6 years ago, her treatment transformed her into a destructive machine. Aurélie could have died or gone insane. She attempted suicide and was then committed to a psychiatric hospital. 6 years ago, with a master's degree in economics, she found a job in New York. She worked hard, went out often, and was close to burnout. She returned to Paris. Her general practitioner was absent, so she met with a psychiatrist. The peaceful young girl was in a rage, and it worried her. So she consulted other doctors. Aurélie had a strong reaction to the dosage increase. A suicide attempt, followed by a psychiatric hospital. She therefore decides to stop the treatment. The violent urges disappeared immediately, but it would take her 2 years to fully recover. Today, Aurélie has rebuilt her life. She lives in London, where she has become a painter, but she still wants to know what really happened. She therefore meets with a reputed British psychiatrist, David Healy. For the pharmaceutical industry, this man is a menace. For years, he has denounced psychotropic medication as dangerous, and his expertise has led to major criticism for the leading laboratories. He claims that these pills are useful, but dangerous.
Well, first of all, the pills can be helpful. I use these pills to treat people, but they don't suit everyone. And when they don't suit you, they can definitely be poisonous. They can make you want to kill yourself. They can make you want to kill other people. And they can generally cause you to hear voices and become crazy. There's certainly about one in 20 people who go on the pills, at least, have what you could call an extreme reaction to them. So that's actually fairly common, okay? Roughly half of the people that go on these pills, they just aren't suited to them. They have a bad reaction, but they don't have an extreme reaction.
If someone has a side effect of the medication, they can say, listen, it's because you had a depression at the beginning, that's why you were like this. So they make you feel that it's because of your first date that you feel so bad. It's not because of the medication.
And this is the problem. This is where things really go wrong, where once you've been put on the pills, doctors don't recognize when they have made things worse. What they say is it's down to doctors. We make the pills, it's down to doctors to use them wisely. If things go wrong, it's the doctor's fault, not ours. Now, the pharmaceutical industry have as much control of the situation as the Soviet Union used to have during the 1960s.
Aurélie comes out of the interview with the impression that she was the victim of a medical error. She thinks about her psychiatrist with a heavy heart. So she will meet up with her 6 years later to finally turn the page. The psychiatrist concedes an error in the diagnosis, but the whole system leads to an increase of psychotropic consumption. It's in the interest of pharmaceutical companies to have a high number of ill people, as psychotropic medication represents a global market of tens of billions of dollars. As the number one user in the world of such medication, France is a true cash register. These happiness pills are making the pharmaceutical companies smile. Their profits exceed those of the petroleum companies. In the United States, this exaggerated medicalization has a particular resonance. As the years went by, unexplained suicides by children taking antidepressants or anxiolytics hit the public opinion. Here, a 10-year-old child is phoning the emergency services. His 14-year-old sister has attempted suicide, having been on Paxil for just a few days, an antidepressant known in France under the name of Seroxat.
This is 911. Who is this? Where is your sister? What is she trying to do? Take pills?
What? No, my dad told me. Hold on, tell me!
GSK, the laboratory that manufactures Paxil, managed to conceal explosive studies conducted by its own experts. Following a court trial, the authorities obliged GSK to reveal the studies. They showed that the medication increased suicidal thoughts or acts by up to 8 times. Massacres perpetrated by teenagers should also be mentioned. 9 out of 10 killers were on a cocktail of psychotropic medication. Despite thousands of people that call for action against the pharmaceutical companies, psychotropic medication remains a bestseller in the U.S. and it's business as usual. Every year, the powerful American Psychiatric Association organizes the most important symposium on the planet. Over 5 days, 15,000 psychiatrists from across the globe attend several conferences. The pharmaceutical industry struck gold. It largely finances the event by promoting its latest medications, and the stands invade an entire hall. For the occasion, even the Vice President of the USA, Joe Biden, is here. This reflects the importance of the event. Leading the American Psychiatric Association is Jeffrey Lieberman, certainly the most influential psychiatrist on the planet. During the press conference, we asked him questions regarding the dangers of psychotropic medication.
These are not dangerous drugs by and large, or certainly no more dangerous than those which are used routinely for other non-psychiatric types of disorders. The side effects should never be a deterrent for somebody who genuinely suffers from depression getting treatment.
This is a disease, a brain disorder, with about a 5% mortality rate. Depression is a disorder where you cannot experience emotion because you feel dead inside. You feel hopeless, helpless, and you would be dead, but you probably don't have the wherewithal to figure out how to commit suicide.
A lot of the over-exaggeration about fears of side effects and are promulgated by people who either don't know or don't want to know, and they foment this.
Is Jeffrey Lieberman best positioned to answer about this medication? The list of pharmaceutical companies that finance him is infinite. We can better understand why Jeffrey Lieberman doesn't much like party poopers, the hundreds of protesters who regularly come to disturb the great gathering of psychiatry. This includes a multitude of associations, as well as the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, which is run by Scientologists. Today's slogan, "Stop Drugging Our Soldiers." A wave of unexpected suicides effectively shook the U.S. Army, and the protesters blame the antidepressants that are administered in 9 out of 10 cases.
22 U.S. veterans are committing suicide every single day. There are more active duty military dying from suicide in 2012 than on the battlefield. There are 49 international drug regulatory warnings on antidepressants that caution against aggression, mania, suicide, in some cases homicidal ideation. It's outrageous. So it's not as if the psychiatrists don't know.
Faced with the protesters, the mainly foreign psychiatrists are somewhat skeptical.
I just discussed a little with them was that there seems to be sometimes it's different to difficult to know if there's a causative relationship. If you have a progression in a disease and you are medicated too, is it the medication or is it the disease itself?
I read the stories that quite a few veterans committed suicide last year, but I was wondering how many suicides have been prevented by taking antidepressants. So I suppose you can't cure everything with just taking a pill. You should give the psychotherapy as well, but I'm not sure if the antidepressants are only responsible for the increased suicide rate.
In the Congress room, many conferences take place one after another, but nobody is dealing with the dangers of antidepressants. One of them is led by Anthony Rothschild, a psychiatrist well known for his successful books on psychotropic drugs. The great specialist is holding a debate on the adaptation of treatments depending on the illness. But not once does he say that antidepressants should not be prescribed. Our question is straightforward.
It seems that there is a lot of danger with antidepressants. What do you think about this? Like suicide or, murders?
No. I mean, I don't know what you're talking about, but I just told you there's no reliable scientific evidence that antidepressants cause people to commit murder or any other crime or suicide.
So how come that on the boxes?
All right, this is not serious, okay?
Is this a surprising reaction? Anthony Rothschild also has conflicts of interest with an impressive number of pharmaceutical companies.
So I told you what I thought. You're going to keep asking me the same question.
Okay,
well, you got my quote, all right?
Okay, very good.
How can such things still be said in this day and age when on all the stands promoting psychotropic medication, whole boards are covered by signs warning of side effects? Among the several side effects, the risk of suicide or violent behavior is prioritized by all. These warnings are a legal obligation enforced by medical organizations. But how much are these warnings worth next to the publicity hype from the pharmaceutical companies?
When you're depressed, where do you want to go? Nowhere. Who do you feel like seeing? No one. Depression hurts in so many ways.
Sadness. These ads banned in France reach tens of millions of households in the United States, one of the rare countries where the promotion of medication is allowed.
That treats many symptoms of depression.
For the promoters of these ads, a new customer is a captive customer.